This is The Guardian.
It's not an easy thing to admit that basically all of us are unintentionally racist.
There's a really great study in which they told teachers, look out for the children who are going to present challenging behavior. And the researchers tracked their eye movements to see who they were looking at, and they found that they disproportionately looked at black children, and in particular, black boys.
Keon West is a professor of social psychology at the University of London and has studied our implicit and explicit biases around race and the consequences they have.
From the day a child is born, the lower expectations, the lower opportunities, the more punitive responses to everything they do wrong. And it becomes really incredible that there's not more of a gap between white people and ethnic minorities in society now, when you think of how much disadvantage piles up on top of them.
And now, Keon has collected his and others' research on this and written a book, The Science of Racism.
This is not the first book about racism, but one of the things that I thought was lacking in some of the previous literature is the explanation of not just what we know about racism, but how scientists know it's an issue. I think most people would like to know what that evidence is.
So today, I hear from Keon about the science of racism and what actually works to make us less racist. I'm The Guardian's science editor, Ian Sample, and this is Science Weekly. Keon says there are many layers to racism, starting with the base foundation.
Racism is any detectable difference in treatment that can be attributed to race when other factors have been excluded. So if a white person and a black person behave the same way but get different treatment, then I call that racism.
Next, there's the bigger power dynamics at play.
If you look at how power is distributed in society, so you look at the percentage of people in the UK who are white, and let's say that's 88%. But then you look at the percentage of millionaires in the UK who are white, and the number goes up to, you know, 90-something percent. And you look at how much white people are represented in government, and it's high, and how much they're represented as judges, that's higher. And so we know that power in society is skewed in a particular way.
Then, at the top, there's the way racism is woven into the fabric of our social structures.
I actually think one of the clearest examples of this isn't even taken from racism literature. It's taken from issues of sexism. People often bemoan the fact that men don't spend as much time with their children as women do. And I have two children. And when my children were born, my wife took between 4 and 6 months off. And I took, you know, between 1 and 2 weeks. And is this because I'm a raging sexist? No, it's not. It's because that's the law. Women get 26 to 52 weeks off, depending on where they work. And men get 1 or 2 weeks off, depending on where they work. And that's written into the system.
You describe lots of studies in the book that demonstrate the widespread presence of racism throughout people's lives, from relationships and health to education, the workplace. I wondered if you could pick out a couple that you found really most striking for you.
I'm a black person, so when you ask me which of these studies are striking, it's a little bit tricky because I can see racism happening all the time. And it's proving it to other people. That's quite a tricky thing. One of the studies I find really quite interesting is a study in which they sent black and white people to a high-end store to try on sunglasses. They dressed the same and they acted the same and they made the same request. But they found that black people were much more likely to be followed around the store and treated with suspicion if they asked for the expensive sunglasses and they asked to try them on. That white people were much more likely to be treated as customers, as people who might be interested in buying the lovely expensive sunglasses. So when someone says, ooh, I think that person's following me around a store because I'm black, and people can say, well, you can't know that it's because you're black. But actually, scientists do know. And I think studies like those are perhaps the most striking, because they are the most subtle things. It's someone just being a little ruder, a little more suspicious of you. And you can prove that, yes, those things are because of racism.
All of the studies Keon wrote about in his book were striking in their own ways. But something that I found particularly arresting was how the effects of racism disadvantage minority ethnic people throughout their lives. In a 2011 study, American school teachers were asked to evaluate recordings of children answering questions in the second and third grade. That's about 7 to 9 years old. Unbeknownst to the teachers, the children were provided with identical responses and had given the answers with similar cadence, fluidity, and sound quality. The teachers evaluated the answers from the minority ethnic children more negatively than their white counterparts. This kind of discrimination continues up the educational ladder. In 2015, another study found that identical emails, supposedly from prospective PhD students, sent to thousands of top university professors, garnered many more responses when they were signed off with white names. It's been documented over and over that CVs with black-sounding names have a much lower callback rate than those with white names, even when every other detail and qualification is the same. In a 2019 study done in the UK across thousands of jobs, the difference was 50%. So, no matter how well you perform in school, no matter how successful you are in your career, this kind of racism doesn't go away, as Keon has shown by studying one of his favorite TV programs.
I love Strictly Come Dancing. I have a background in partner dancing myself. I used to teach salsa, which many people don't know, but I started when I was 15, back when I lived in Jamaica, and I love Strictly. And I think you should watch it if you don't watch it. It's a great show.
Much to Keon's dismay, I've never watched Strictly, and so I got him to explain how it works and how he used it to study racism.
I think of Strictly Come Dancing as a combination of partner dancing and The Hunger Games, which I think is what makes it so exciting. So what you have is 15 couples, or about 15, at the start of every season, and every week you lose a couple because whoever's at the bottom of the ranking, or the two couples at the bottom of the ranking, face each other in a dance-off. And that's how you know who's not doing very well. The way you get to the bottom of the ranking is by doing two things. One, you get very low scores from the judges. And two, you don't get a lot of votes from the viewing public. Now, we as the viewing public, we don't see the votes. They keep that very secret. But you can use some basic maths to figure out who's not being voted for by the viewing public. And by running it over, I think, 10 seasons of Strictly, there was a disturbing pattern in which you are least likely to get votes from the viewing public if you are an ethnic minority celebrity paired with an ethnic minority professional dancer. And if you have very high scores, what happens to you is that you end up being in a lot of subsequent dance-offs because essentially you're a very good dancer, but you're not getting the votes. I thought it was a reminder that you never get big enough that racism stops. People in Strictly are some of the most recognizable and beloved and interesting people on British television. And, you know, they're also disproportionately beautiful people and wealthy people and people with all sorts of advantages. But even then, at the top of your game, you can't escape it.
Keon, you could describe a lot of the studies we've spoken about so far as demonstrating the consequences of unconscious bias, that the managers aren't consciously discriminating against CVs with black-sounding names, or that when people are voting on Strictly for the white couples, they're not consciously doing so because of their race. But you argue that unconscious bias isn't the right term to use. Why is that?
The reason I resist not so much the use of the term, but the blanket assumption that all bias is unconscious, is frankly because that's obviously not true. I did a study, I think it was a 2019 one, on dating preferences. And the interesting thing about the study was the methodology of it, that normally when we go looking for racism, we ask people questions in sneaky ways. So half of the participants see the white Christian version of the crime report and the other half read the brown Muslim version of the crime report. And then we get them to judge it, but they never realize that they're judging exactly the same thing as someone else, just with the race swapped around. But I did a study on dating preferences in which I gave people all the same questions. How likely are you to date or to marry or to have casual sex with a white person, a black person, an East Asian person, a South Asian person? So the people who were in the survey, they knew exactly what I was asking them. And they overwhelmingly said, yes, yes, I would like more white people, please. And then ethnic minorities following after a substantial gap. And then ethnic minorities in particular orders as well. And there's been other research where they get black, white, and a lot of this is done in the US, so also Latino people coming in to interview for particular jobs. And they would just lie to the black people and to the Latinos. They just lie to them. They lied and pretended the position was closed. They lied and pretended that there were no interviews when there were interviews. And so it's just not true that all these biases are unconscious. Most of us do racist stuff some of the time, but don't like to think about that. And so we come up with clever defense strategies to hide from ourselves and other people that this is what we're doing. And we've known that's not true in the social psychological arena for decades. And I think it's time that we just remind everyone else that we know it's not true.
Instead, researchers often use the term implicit bias, the internalized stereotypes and associations that affect our perceptions and attitudes. You might have heard this term in relation to the Harvard Implicit Association Test, where you're asked to categorize images and words on a screen as quickly as possible. When the categorizations are attuned to your implicit biases, you can do the task faster. I'd recommend giving it a go. Our implicit biases are shaped by and shape the world around us, and it begins pretty much as soon as we're born. Any parent will have had that moment when they thought, how has my kid picked up on that? To show how strongly and early our biases are formed, in 1947, researchers performed a study where black children aged 3 to 7 were asked about their preferences towards dolls with white skin and yellow hair and brown skin and black hair. The children could identify the race of the dolls with almost 100% accuracy. But when they were asked which doll they wanted to play with or which one was the nice doll, they picked the white doll more frequently than the brown doll. Two of the children cried when they were asked which doll they looked like. They didn't want to be the brown doll. Now you might be thinking, that was 1947, things are surely different now. To see if that was true, researchers did a similar study in 2021.
What they found is that things really hadn't changed that much. There was evidence of the black children being less interested in the black dolls, being less likely to play with them, being more likely to fight over some other kind of doll before they played with the black dolls. They also found a disturbing new dimension of violence towards the black dolls, of cooking the black dolls or poking them in the eye or doing other such terrible things to them that they didn't do to the white dolls. So the study was quite sobering. The one thing I would say, maybe as a point of contention, is yes, we do pick up on these things quickly, but I don't want to make light of how much it takes to make us pick up on these things. If you ask people certain basic questions, if they have children, to show you all of their children's books, and you look through all the children's books, and you try to find a single children's book with a non-white character in it, you probably won't find any. And if you do find them, they'll probably be in the background. And if they're not in the background, they might be doing something a bit dodgy. And if you ask most people to name a single book in which there's a black protagonist, they have a hard time, or in which there's a black father who takes care of children, they have a hard time. But when you look at the things we absorb, we don't absorb this in a day or in a week. It is years of being bombarded with messages about who is pretty, who is smart, who is caring. And those messages often leave ethnic minorities out. And that's why children learn those things.
Keon, the next question you address in the book is how to deal with racism scientifically. And one fixture of, you know, almost all modern workplaces, I'm sure, is unconscious bias or diversity training. And, you know, on the surface, you think that's got to be a good thing. You know, we're being reminded of our biases and the ways that they're damaging and hurtful. So we're then able to adjust our behavior, would be the thinking. But you argue that the evidence that it works doesn't necessarily hold up. What do we know about the sort of effectiveness of bias training?
Yes. Well, first of all, I want to acknowledge that many people are probably doing their bias training with the best of intentions. But I do think if we're going to do things scientifically, we do have to ask ourselves, well, how would you know that it works? And one way in which you could test for it would be to take hundreds of companies over a period of decades, track how diverse and inclusive they are, see whether or not they do unconscious bias training, and then later on, see if the ones that did the unconscious bias training became more diverse and more inclusive afterwards. So the effects of diversity and bias training are small a lot of the time, but sometimes they're negative. So mandatory unconscious bias training, mandatory diversity training, was found by a set of studies to actually have negative effects, to make workplaces less diverse and less inclusive on a number of different metrics. The people who were told, oh, bias is unconscious, they were less concerned about the bias. They thought people should not be held accountable for the bias, and they were less interested in any consequences for the bias. And that's just one window into why this might not be working.
Are there better ways to reduce racism? And by that, I suppose I mean ways that, you know, companies could bring in that just have more research evidence backing them up.
Yes. And that's one of the most frustrating things, that knowing how to reduce racism, it's not a secret. I feel like someone who has Fountain of Youth water just flowing out of my tap at home. And I watch people go on long treks through the desert and over the mountains to find a pond of it. And they put a lot of work into finding out things that we've known for an incredibly long time. And I don't understand why that is. So there are many things that we know reduce bias. Something that I studied a lot is called intergroup contact, which is literally just getting people to interact with each other across groups. If you do that, you probably find that the people you hate aren't worthy of your hate in the way that you imagine. And it sounds very flippant to say, but it is something that people debated for a long time, especially in the 1940s and 50s when segregation was very popular. But huge amounts of evidence came out to say, no, this is very, very clear. The more you get people to spend time with each other, the more they like each other. And it's one of the most reliable ways of reducing bias. And there are definitely diversity interventions that make real differences. These are in particular structural interventions or interventions that change the power dynamics in the organization, interventions that change how resources are distributed so that whether or not people like you, things become more egalitarian because the laws and the structure of the society or the organization have changed to make things better. And we know that these things work. And so it's a little bit of a puzzle why they're not used more often. Why people are doing this mountainous trek to find the fountain of less bias. When there's loads of less bias at home, we have it. We've known how to do it. We've been publishing about it for years, but people don't do it.
Keon, thanks for talking to me.
Oh, well, thank you. That was really nice.
My thanks again to Professor Keon West. You can find his book, The Science of Racism, on The Guardian Bookshop. Just go to guardianbookshop.com. We've also put a link to that in the podcast description. And that's it for today. This episode was produced by Madeline Finley. It was sound designed by Tony Onochuku, and the executive producer is Ellie Bury. We'll be back next Tuesday with some answers to your questions on health and fitness. See you then.
With social media bosses firing their fact-checkers or openly campaigning for the far right. If you want to understand this moment in the world, not through platforms owned by some billionaire, but through people on the ground working to arrive at the truth. Listen to Today in Focus from The Guardian every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Guardian.